not going to my big sister. Let me be mad for a while, unhinged, by some passion made daring and deliberate, lured into the heart's motion, the wild summer, broad and daredevil sky. Inebriate with longing, mad with love or poetry, the dangerous deliriums of flying. In this madness we can reach, young in our reckless hopes, old in our dreaming, shaken loose and shocked, with sorrow, salt our crying. We will not regret how it made us different, changed our looking hearts, until we could see the light. With the poem called Betaniah, that was the first poem in the first book. First published poem is the title poem, Birds' Nests. We learned about God from birds' nests, and those tabernacles perched in a hedge, hidden between moss-covered stones in a ditch, or under the lip of some ledge. When you found one, it was a secret you kept to yourself. I had seven that were mine. My brother had more, but he was bigger than me. And anyway, crows didn't count. They were too high up. You had to be able to see into them. My uncle lifted me up to see if the one that had blue eggs in it. That counted all right. My mother said the one I showed her was a robin's nest. Her breast was red because she felt sorry for our Lord on the cross, and blood dripped from the nails onto her breast, and the spot never came off. You had to be silent. It was like being in church. Touching the eggs was a sin. It was like lifting a girl's skirt. I put my hand in once to see how they felt. They were smooth, like my sister's hair, warm like her skin. I told her in confession, said I never do it again. Dunnigan lived near the school. He said birds' nests were a con. He robbed them under the walls, took his hand right into the hole. It came out with the eggs in his fist. We could hear the cracking of shells, see the ooze through his fingers, like sick. His face had a crooked look. He wiped the edge off his hand on Mary Christine's breast. Something about innocence and the loss of innocence. And the confusion between what is innocent and what is otherwise. We walked to school, to the fields as it happens, on a 3-mile journey, and there was a gentleman who lived on a corner. He was an old man who lived alone, and he talked to himself. And now and again we stop to listen. This poem is called Sam Gosling's Corner. Sam Gosling's orchard was hidden in the growth behind the grain mound. The trick would be to wake Sam first, not have him woken by his squall of cats. Our bare feet made no sound on a cold, blank floor. With only the ticking of the clock and Sam's afternoon snore. "What's the time, sir?" The master said his name was Mr. Gosnell, and we should call him Sir. "What's the time, sir?" "3:30, he said. The apple trees were friendly, familiar like his trousers of grey fries. We took an apple each and ran back past his house, and heard him talking to himself. "Isn't that little now? Kettle boiled, potato ready, and no bread." We had them all the way to Kingston Bridge, and paired our teeth marks on the course, and raced them down the river at the count of 3. Mine was winning, till it sank. "You could tell an apple from its taste," we said. Sam's tasted sort of Protestant. Chopped apples seduced us after that. They were from foreign parts, and painted lips and polished skin. Their taste had no religion. The opening poem in this book is called The Fields. Our farm was in the family from back in the 1700s. And about 7 years ago, my brother decided to sell the farm. I suspect that this poem came from that news. on the fields. I should say that in the 17th century the native language was Irish. And then around 1831, Sir Brian Creel's great translations, cartographers came and anglicized the names. Dún Vaughan Dwee became Dún Menwe. Gael Lorcan became Valley de Hob. And so on and so on, right through the country, every town, village, and townland. And then the head schools were replaced by the official schools and came to the end. So the generation before my father and the father's generation had no Irish. But the fields still are the original names. If you know Irish, you recognize some of the fields. Before Aunt Nora ever sent me that prayer book with the red cover, before St. Alfred the Great and the man who believed in with God, before school books and the books from the library van, I was reading the fields by the road of the land. The pathway that ran straight as a story through the middle of the field below the house, coming to a full stop at the well. The pond where the gander ruled and the geese hissed, the hill field and the meadow with the chain pulled. The brake, its folds dressed forever in yellow curves, its spiders hiding in their nylon webs. Park of the birth, the bog, the field with the rabbits, where the rabbits sat on the rock, and the collared field, and the road that ran down to the inches, and the river singing its own song. The big inch where we learned to swim, the coarse inch where we galloped the horse, the long inch where the hares had their set and the blood came out, and the spot where my father hid, up to his nose after drowning the dog, time of the battle tents. The gravel field with the dugout where they slept, the briar field, Catherine's bog, Clinical Oak, Rathmilling and Clashitopple, the field by the road and the field of the rest. The Moon 18 Park, the barrack of the cabbage garden, and the field in front of the house. These were cows grazed in summer evenings and trudged home way down with milk. The heifers stood stock still under trees, grizzled gathering like jewels on their backs. The field where the fox jumped out with the ferns brazen at the sky and the hen in his mouth. Fields in spring where potato fields were lines on a page. Autumn fields lyrical with oats, verses of barley and stooks. Turnips and winter fields, exclamation marks on the frozen ground. They're all one field now, it is a thing of the past. With my bare feet still, the grammar and the rest.
Stretched out like the priest when he was saying mass.
Kitty Kelly came visiting my sisters. She joined in. She took the ball of wool inside her cardigan. They all giggled. I said our teacher, Mrs. Fitzgerald, had two apples under her jumper. Her jumper was knitted in the shop. They were all laughing when I said that. They told me to go and play outside. My mother didn't laugh when I told her about Kitty Kelly and the ball of wool. When I told her about Mrs. Fitzgerald and the apples, she gave a smile. Later on, it got all mixed up. Adam and Eve, the serpent, apples, the delicate indecencies of them. Climbing Mount Everest by Sir Edmund Hillary. My father didn't like the Sir, who was like God Save the Queen. And he thought climbing mountains was no trial of a man. There isn't much mass in that sort of thing around here. I carried on reading all the same, tagging along behind Hillary and fencing, oxygen masks, tackle ropes, all the gear, crampons, even though I didn't know what they were. Sunday evening, somewhere between the apple tree and the gooseberry bush, we set out from base camp. At 29,000 feet and snowbound, I could feel the freezing inside my skin. I was climbing higher and higher into the thin air when my father shouted, "Michael, go for the cows." Milking the cow in the southern stall, I imagined our final assault. The spurt of milk from the base of the metal bucket was the sound of the wind. The sound growing hollower and coarser, sorry, the sound growing hollower and coarse as the bucket filled, or our footsteps crunching on snow, or rasping for breath. Resting below the summit, milk almost up to the rim, the cow rolled in a great avalanche, pinning me against the wall. The bucket went flying, the milk spread out like a sudden fall. The snow of my mountaintop melting into the straw. Years later, I read, the first thing Hillary said was, "We knocked the bastard off." I like that. But I like now our fencing net in the snow on the summit of Chomolungma, the home of the gods. Smoking. I've never smoked, except that one time when I found a fag in a gold flake box my father thought was finished. I left it until Sunday night and the rest of them were gone to the dance. I listened to the top 20 then first, then snuck it inside my shirt and headed off down the Boreen to the bottom of the hill. There, beside the well where the horses drank, I lit up and gave a pull. I watched it redden, and giddily blew the smoke out of my mouth. Number one was Stranger on the Shore by Mr. Ackerbilk. The excitement was knowing I wouldn't be found out. Next thing, a yellow hammer blew out of a furnace bush. I'm glad now I never took it up, but I'd like to see another yellow hammer. I wouldn't mind listening to Mr. Acker. One more in that vein, the English exam. I wasn't that good at memorizing things, but I was pretty good at making things up. The sport in West Park is road bowling. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it. It's an iron bowl, 28 ounces. And you cover the distance in approximately 20 shots, so it's called the score, for the score. And if I've got to that bush in 17 shots and you've taken 19, then I'm 2 balls. That means I'm doing well. English exam. I was a ball of odds before the start. They all said John Lacey was a cert. I learned everything about sea fever by heart. It was cargoes came up. I knew cargoes began with Queen Quirinae, which I couldn't spell, and that amethyst, isthmus, and topazist, which I couldn't pronounce, never mind spell. Right in appreciation of cargoes, quoting the poem in full, I said I certainly appreciated cargoes, but I thought sea fever was ocean to him. I said sea fever was a class of a disease. I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky. Anyone who read it would catch the disease, and anyone who'd never even seen the sea could see why. I must go down to the seas again. With the call of the running tide, I said Mitchkin had it so bad he was broke out in a lather of sweat. And as the wild call and the clear call that may not be denied, at the time I got the measles, only worse. Sea fever was contagious, I said, without a cure. And I was willing to bet John Masefield wasn't in the better of it yet. When I read the next question, I knew I'd lost the score. The historical figure supporting your essay with facts. I couldn't think of any figure that wasn't good on facts, so I made one up. I made up the facts as well. I reinvented my father. I wrote everything I knew about him and a whole lot that I didn't. And he was a hero of the flying column, and his name was Timothy McAndrew, and he was a fright. And he shot 40 blackened hands in one night. Afterward, they were all saying they'd written about Parnell and Michael Collins and Clark Pierce. One fellow wrote about Winston Churchill. While Kylie asked me what I'd written about, I admitted what I'd done. Remind yourself, was all he said. I was an honor once again. Thanks very much. My normal congregation is in a church. My day job is I'm a priest. Ordained 42 years ago this summer. 2 years ago when I was celebrating my 40th, I went back to my first parish, which is in Halifax, Yorkshire. A lot of memories came back and several poems came. This one was the first. On the morning Bobby Kennedy died. You need to know that a dalmatic is the best one that a deacon wears. Dalmatics, red, gold, purple, off-white, have been allocated in pairs. Steve and I get the green ones, Eamon and Billy, red. Dr. Sealbred is giving the organ full throttle and we process him. The ceremony lasts 2 hours. And when we come back out, it's done. We're in it now for the long haul. Next year will be ordination proper. Matt Mahan, with the rust-colored hair, is at the door offering congratulations. Allow me, Mick. You're allowed. A few of the boys have lit up with relief. I'm basking in the afterglow of it. The organist followed us outside, mixing in the smell of laburnum and cut grass. The sky is overcast. Someone says, Bobby Kennedy is dead. I didn't even know he'd been shot. There was an old woman in the parish that felt a bit sorry for me. She thought I was a bit lacking in street wisdom. She had left Belfast in the year 1912 in the great riots and moved to Halifax, settled down, got married. In the early years of her marriage, her husband's brother lodged with her. And this poem is pretty much verbatim. It's called Shillelagh. She had this shillelagh about 2.5 feet. The mother talked not your touristy thing, the proper ones. Shillelagh, keep that beside your bed, she said, showing me the shine on it. That's what I've done with it all my life. After setting the table for breakfast, after feeding the cat, after getting the rent money out of his brother on the Thursday night, coppers, I call his brother, hey up, where's the coppers? You wouldn't know what they'd be up to around here, son. Put that beside your bed and God help any burglar tries to break you. That there broke Protestant skulls in 1912. My mother gave it to me for my wedding. I haven't had to use it much. It was my first time living in any place other than the countryside. And it was a huge sprawling parish with an urban jungle. People were the salt of the earth, but they didn't have two brass farthings rubbed together. And they lived mostly on their wits. This poem is called 47 Grasmere Drive, which is the only lie in the poem. I changed the address because I didn't want anybody coming after me. 47 Grasmere Drive. Discarded items lie half hidden in the garden. The tricycle, an upturned fan, its wheels missing. A black dog is curled up on the torn out couch. The boy is about 8, his face round as the sun. Is your mother in, I ask? Are you the man from the YEB who works your electricity board? The mother hasn't paid her bill, and for a good reason. They cut her off. Mr. O'Hara, who lives next door, has kindly connected her to the meter in his house, which is connected to the meter in the next house. I'm not from the YEB, I tell him. I'm the priest. Hold on, I'll find out if she's in. We're not Catholics, he says when he comes back. We're down here as Catholics, I say, waving my book. We used to be, but now we're not. Mum says she's not in. That's fine, I say. Tell her I'm not here. And a more recent one, most parishes have one person who has been there a long time. There are two churches in my parish. One is an old landed gentry church that was built in 1854. Attached to Scarlingwell Hall, which was there from about the 14th century pre-Reformation. Tess Carr had looked after it from when her dad was the coachman at the hall, and she was about 5. She gave me the key of the door and the key of the safe, but nothing more. She regarded me with some suspicion because she was sure I knew my place. And we grew too fond of each other even though we never admitted it. And I discovered that she used to brag to her atheist neighbors things like, I don't know if he's written a poem this week. And then we had a conversation and I wrote this poem and I asked somebody if I should show it to her and they advised me not. And I took their advice, and then she died. And I showed the poem to her sister, and she said, you have to read this at the funeral, because that was Tess. So, theologically speaking, in memory of Tess Carr, 1921 to 2003. The church there beside the lake, hunchbacked against the wind since 1854. In the background, Cardinal Wiseman see her, growing taller every year. Close by, the grass cut, the undergrowth cleared away, a small wooden cross, now obvious. Who's buried here, I ask. Bernadette, she says. My eyebrows puzzled. The cat. Realizing this wasn't your average cat, I hesitate. It's not a matter of being small-minded or anything, but theologically speaking, Jesus didn't die for cats, for the grave be marked, say, by a shrub. Over a medium-sized pause, my suggestion is dismissed. She did enough for this church. Everybody loved that. Theology will have to please itself. May Bernadette have eternal rest. The first line of St. John's Gospel says, in the beginning was the Word. What a marvelous opening line. This poem is called In the Beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was the beginning, the not yet spoken, spoken, the untold, toldness, telling. And the Word was a breath, a small spill of breath, tongue touched into a whisper from the beginning of breathing. And the whisper lingered, ebbed itself over the riverbanks, out of the deepest gullies between the swill of water and water. And the waters mirrored the word that was a breath that was a whisper that became the Word in the beginning. And the Word grew bright in all the galaxies, in the mirror of waters among the tall grasses. A man came, a man John. He was not the light, but the light was in him, so that his dark breath brightened. And the stab of light was a pillar in the valley, an arch over the holly, and shine on the wet berry. They hovered over the trees, swung from branch to branch, leaped on the hard ground into the earth, shuddered. And the Word laughed, and the Word wept, and the Word became flesh, as it was in the beginning. In reverse. I don't know how I do it, or when it was that I learned. I've always been able. You see, I read maps backwards. Someone draws me a map, I have to look at it in the mirror. I see it left to right, back to front. Maybe that's fine. I can write backwards as well, just as easily as the other way around. And it's no less of a scrawl. I did it for the kids to show them how clever I was. They'd run off looking for a mirror. Once the moss just turned the page over and read from the back. Clever kid, then. But what I was coming to, I'm known as an erratic driver, and I can't cut bread straight. But I can reverse into a space the size of a snap. I don't know how, I just take one look, and no matter how tight, I'm in there first go. I think it's to do with the way I angle my neck. I end up a whisper from the curb and exactly parallel, 6 inches to spare, front and back. I do the best when I know. You know, when you're on holidays and you're reading, a couple of good novels, a couple of books of poetry, and all the stuff you intended reading, and you're on the beach and the water is nice and it's warm, and you think you're home and the work you don't have to go through and all sorts of false schools because you're laid back and chilled out. I went on a cheap winter holiday to the Gambia a few years back, and this poem is called Beach Coming. After a poem of the same name by George McLeod Brown in the Orkney poem. On day one, a pair of dolphins appear. They swim parallel to the shore. They watch each other, then they're gone. I see them no more. On day two, I search the shingles and find a flat, huge stone. I skim it into the shimmer waves, lose it in the sun. On day three, I sail out of Boston and board the whaler to Tampa. Our mission, to rescue the Fenian convict from the mountain. On the fourth day, a fine, figured blonde woman walks my way. I see the skin of her neck shriveled, her face half eaten away. On the fifth day, a hermit crab crawls out of his shell. The time to grow another, I keep the original. On day six, the throne, a black woman walks out of the sea. Says she is Queen Esther, she is healed me under the medicine tree. On day seven, I read about scalping in Texas in 1849. A white horse rides by with pink fetlocks, not orange mane. On the eighth day, a waiter in Mickey Mouse Pier says the food is good. 500% better than yesterday, guaranteed. Sundown, day nine, the incessant sound of an African drum. Prevent us from error, prevent us from error, from error. Amen. I'm good for time. I read one or maybe two recent ones just to keep the news sweet. This one's called Something Happened, and it's in memory of my mum. Something happened to them, she'd say. If they were back late, or if it got dark, and there was still no sign of them, especially if they were at the races. She'd start getting restless, doors opening and closing, then put on her coat over the blue apron and go outside. She'd walk north to the stable and the milk turns, south of Turkwick. You hear anxious exhaled prayers over the hedge. Jesus, mercy. go up to the cross street, say, like a good boy, and see if there's any trace of them. Or go east of Dan, maybe they'd heard something. And you go up the road in the dark as far as the cabbage garden. You slow down when you came to the corner near the spot, in case he was there and wanted to say something. Well, you knew he wouldn't, because he was in heaven. Still, you can never be sure. So you wait a bit, then take a deep breath and run, making the noise so everything else will drown out. Then you stand at the cross, look north and south, and you know there was no fear. Nothing ever happened again. Were the usual falls off bikes, damaged elbows, broken wrists, cut knees. Nothing like that. As we grew up, things got better. Not that she ever got over. I was invited down to spend a term at a theology faculty in Canberra, about 5 years ago. And got a few poems, this is one of them, that I wrote fairly recently called Canberra. You wait to find blood on the pillow, face and lips crusted, taste of blood in your mouth. Alarmed, you jump out of bed. Only your nosebleed, the mirror says. Wash it off, then go outside. You walk between the plots of native grasses, stand up among the totem poles, near the water garden at the foot of the stainless steel cross. Silence hangs on the leaves of the eucalyptus. You drive out to the hill overlooking the city. Parking at the golf club, you pass the sprinklers, feel the moisture on your sandals. 4 kangaroos lie beside a bunker, a dozen congregate under trees. They watch motionless as you come closer. Then turn and run, pounding and gliding across 3 fairways, they wheel down the valley, coming to a stop inside a pool of light. You watch them, watch. The sun came up. I'll read one, I know a new one. It's called Westerners. It was the Lone Ranger start with me off when I was 7. First thing home from school, I'd read the comic strip on the Cork Examiner. See if he'd capture the outlaws or got himself out of a scrape. One time with his gun belt on and his hands tied behind his back, they were just going to take his mask off. I was very frightened for him, but Silver galloped off to find Tonto and they got there just in time. Years later, I went to see him at the pavilion on Patrick Street. He spoke with an American twang. I felt betrayed. It was worse than taking his mask off. And the examiner's accent was the same as mine. I had no time for him after that, but I still watched and read Westerns. I loved the long rides out on the prairie, the lights under the cold stars, the shootouts. Sainsbury's Riders of the Purple Sage. My favorite was Louis L'Amour. I liked the sound of his name and the title of his books. High Lonesome, Down the Long Hills, Showdown at Yellow Butte. And I loved being in them. I swapped them with Steve, the fastest gun alive. Westerns are the last thing on my mind that summer I fly out to Colorado. I want to be in the wild. I drive west from Pueblo, wrapped on the Colorado River, then on out to Ouray and over the San Juan Highway. I stop at Snake Pass and pick a wildflower. Indian paintbrush, columbine, for each person that I love. I arrive in Durango at dusk. I pull into a hotel that says John Wayne slept here. Later I happen on the Louis L'Amour Saloon. His rocking chair is out front, and beside it a rack displaying his books. My eye lands on The Man from Skibbereen. And see a Western after my hometown. A quick browse tells me it's not very good. He just liked the sound of the name. Tomorrow I'll head south to Mesa Verde, Tonight I'll step inside and be a cowboy again. The website shows he died that summer, though nobody in Durango knew. 100 books, sales of 300 million, a 30 book deal with Benson. 23 years on, he's still turning them out. Two new ones in 2011. Last summer, I met up with Steve again, in a wheelchair now and home from Texas. What was it about Westerns? I asked him. The scenery, he said.
Machine. It was around 1957.
"There you are," he said, pointing up at the big screen. "I see myself coming towards me. I'm wearing that checked grey overcoat. I walk out of the screen past myself and notice the overcoat is baggy. I'm bulkier than I thought. As I walk up the terrace steps, I observe myself in the back. My hair is standing up, thicker than I remember. It's turning from grey to black. When I look again at the screen, the video is finished. I want to see the playback. The remote is out of reach. I'm looking for a window opener or that long-handled candle snuffer when a woman asks me if she can help. She gets the tape, reel to reel, and puts it into the machine. I ask if it can be fast-forwarded. She says not. I have to watch it from the start." Finally, one for the road, last will and tea. "To you, my high horse, I leave this original saddle. The stirrups thrown in for luck as well as the rest of the tack. And after you have galloped off, I leave the echo of your hooves to the heather, or what's left of the morning air to the ducks in the water lily lake. And I leave the ring of my doorbell to the empty room, to the stained carpet where Charlie knocked over the soup when he got drunk in emptiness until he was full of light. For the rest, I leave the benefit of the doubt, now and at the hour of my day. Thank you very much."